let's pick up where we left off in the Gospel of John. We left off, I believe, in the chapter 19. This is a continuation, obviously, of 18, where Jesus has basically been put on trial before Pilate. And, of course, Pilate is trying his darndest to get out of a very, very uncomfortable situation that he finds himself in, because he recognizes, he realizes that Jesus is just being railroaded to his death by people who they don't have a shred of evidence of any wrongdoing against him. He just realized that they are resentful and jealous of him, and Pilate knows this in his heart of hearts, and he finds himself on two horns of a dilemma, simply because he, for one thing, he isn't in very good standing with Rome. And as a governor, it was his responsibility to go down to Judea every time they had one of these big, huge religious holidays. He was supposed to be going down there and keep order. And he recognizes that if this crowd gets out of hand and people begin rioting or become a real unruly mob, then his job's on the line. I mean, he sees that. So he's really vacillating between what to do here. And history has shown that, well, Pilate just has not been able to wash his guilt away, even though he had really attempted to do so, because he was in a position to do the right thing, but he compromised instead, and so he's gone down in history because of that. And I think that there's a lot to be gleaned from that in terms of our, you know, just human nature, and how any one of us in his shoes could have just as easily done the same thing. But it's a warning and it's a message to us in terms of, okay, are we going to have the moral courage and the fortitude to stand up for what's right, even though it's going to cost us in the end? I mean, it's always easy to do the expedient thing, but the bottom line is, how is this going to play out in eternity? How is it going to play out before God? Anyway, beginning with verse 1 in chapter 19. Then Pilate therefore took Jesus and scourged him, and the soldiers wove a crown of thorns and put it on his head, and they arrayed him in a purple robe, and they began to come up to him and say, "Hail, King of the Jews," and give him blows in the face. And Pilate came out again and said to them, "Behold, I am bringing him out to you, that you may know that I find no guilt in him." And Jesus therefore came out wearing a crown of thorns and a purple robe, and Pilate said to them, "Behold the man." When therefore the chief priests and the officers saw him, they cried out, saying, "Crucify him, crucify, crucify." Pilate said to them, "Take him yourselves and crucify him, for I find no guilt in him." The Jews answered him, quote, "We have a law, and by that law he ought to be died, because he made himself out to be the Son of God," unquote. When Pilate therefore heard this statement, he was more afraid, and he entered into the praetorium again and said to Jesus, "Where are you from?" And Jesus gave him no answer. Pilate therefore said to him, "You do not speak to me. Do you not know that I have the authority to release you, and I have the authority to crucify you?" And Jesus answered, "You would have no authority over me unless it had been given to you from above. For this reason, he who delivered me up to you has the greater sin." As a result of this, Pilate made efforts to release him, but the Jews cried out, saying, "If you release this man, you are no friend of Caesar's. Everyone who makes himself out to be a king opposes Caesar." And when Pilate therefore heard these words, he brought out Jesus out and sat down on the judgment seat in a place called the pavement, but in Hebrew is Gabbatha. Now it was the day of the preparation for the Passover, and it was about the sixth hour, and he said to the Jews, "Behold your king," and they therefore cried out, "Away with him, away with him, crucify him." And Pilate said to them, "Shall I crucify your king?" And the chief priests answered, "We have no king but Caesar." So he then delivered him up to them to be crucified. Okay, before I go any further, let's just back up, because what's really pathetic about Pilate is, actually, if you just back up to chapter 18, if you just back up and look at that verse 8:38, and it says, "Pilate said to him, said to Jesus, 'What is truth?' And when he had said this, he went out again and said to the Jews, 'I find no guilt in him.'" And then if you look down in verse 6, it says, in the last part of that verse 6, it says, "Take him yourself and crucify him, for I find no guilt in him." Pilate was saying and admitting over and over again that he didn't find any guilt in Jesus. But look what he tries to do to appease the crowd. First of all, he doesn't find any guilt in him, but he delivers him over to have him scourged, hoping that this is going to be some kind of way to just satisfy the bloodthirsty appetites of these people, in some way to appease them. And I think that this is a solemn warning to all of us. When we get into a situation where we try to appease evil, where we feel like, okay, we'll give them this far and no further, or we'll give them this much and no further, you find yourself in a situation where it's never enough when you're dealing with evil. You really have to dig in your heels and say, no, I'm not giving in on this point. Because look at, back up to that first verse, in that first one in chapter 19, it says, "Then Pilate therefore took Jesus and scourged him, and the soldiers wove a crown of thorns and put it on his head and arrayed him in a purple, and they began to come up to him saying, 'Hail, King of the Jews,' and give him blows in the face." Now, here's the situation, okay? He turns him over to be scourged, turns him over to be beaten by the authorities. And I've read, you know, in various exobiblical literature how they used to have a kind of a game between these Roman soldiers, and what they would do is they blindfold a person who was being, you know, beaten by them. And basically what they do is somebody would go up and they just give this criminal or this person on trial, clobber him, just punch him in the face as hard as they could, and then they take the blindfold off and they say, okay, who hit you? But first, before they put the blindfold on, they'd all show them their fists, and then you'd have to decide, and then the person would have to be able to come up and say who hit them. And if he couldn't come up with the right answer, then they'd blindfold them again, and then, you know, they'd keep this up and keep it up and keep it up. Well, we know from the reading Isaiah 53 that it says that Jesus was marred more than any man. You can imagine that they went far beyond the 39 lashes, and they just continued to beat him and to mock him, to ridicule him. You know, it just went on and on and on and on. Okay, so when he comes back out to Pilate, the guy is a bloody mess. I mean, he's just they've made hamburger out of him. They not only have mocked him, but they put a crown of thorns on him, and they put a robe on him, and they just completely have ridiculed him. Now, Jesus, he obviously looks pathetic, and Pilate is thinking to himself, man, this has got to draw some sympathy. This has got to draw these people to a point where they just say, oh, well, okay, hopefully he's learned his lesson, and now everybody go home. This is what Pilate is trying to do. He's trying to appease. And there's a dark warning to us all. And as a matter of fact, I just wanted to share this with you. I wrote this thing that I sent to the papers. It's kind of timely, but it deals with what we were dealing with, the stem cell, embryonic stem cell research. This is what I wrote, and I actually got a call from the Press Tribune the other day. I wasn't home, but the editor had left a message. He wanted to confirm that I had written this. So hopefully, at least one of the papers will pick it up. But this is what I wrote. I said, "Bush's cowardly compromise on embryonic stem cell research has now opened a Pandora's box of horrors that will eventually make the Nazi extermination camps and their medical experimentations look tame in comparison. Like Pontius Pilate of old, Bush's fleeting political career has become more important to him than the integrity and moral courage to do what is right in his sight of Almighty God. Mr. Bush will never be able to wash away the blood of millions of dissected and dismembered children that will soon result from his federal funding of their executioners and of the mad men and women who are hell-bent on becoming, quote-unquote, like the Most High," Ezekiel 14:14. "The president declared, if these embryos are going to be destroyed anyway, why not use them for a good purpose," unquote. This is exactly the reasoning of the Nazi SS, who had boxcars crammed with human beings who were, quote-unquote, going to be destroyed anyway, so, quote-unquote, why not use them for a good purpose? It doesn't take a genetic engineer to comprehend what scientists and others will say if researchers someday discover that the fetal tissue and body parts of a seven-month-old fetus or a week-old handicapped baby possesses the potential to cure cancer or eliminate AIDS. Hollywood, the media, the gay community, and the slumbering and dumbed-down masses of humanity will be screaming in the name of compassion, quote-unquote, crucify them, crucify them. Yes, there is a way that seems right unto man, but the end thereof is death," Proverbs 14:12. "And Nazi Germany once believed that their ways were right, so America is now blindly following in her destructive footprints." This is what happens when you try to appease evil. When you're confronted with evil and you just feel like, okay, I'll just give in this far and hopefully this will be the end of it. And this is what happened when Hitler was just running roughshod all over Europe. It's like the other powers who could have stood up to him kept saying, okay, we'll give him this much and this much. And, you know, he took the Rhineland and took Austria and he took Czechoslovakia and took the Sudetenland. And then he just kept taking more and more and more. They kept thinking, well, when is this guy going to stop? Until finally, you know, when he took Poland, it was all out war broke out. But it was all that appeasement all along the way when they were dealing with this evil that, you know, you see what you're dealing with. And what we're dealing with here, we're dealing with the devil. And the devil always wants us to believe that, hey, all I want is just this much, and that's all I want. Okay, the same thing with this embryonic stem cell stuff. Okay, they say all we want is these embryos that are going to be thrown out. Do you really believe that? I mean, are people smoking dope when they're born on the moon to really believe that that's where it's going to stop? Now, granted, private research all along has been doing this. You know, they've been trying to play God in the laboratories with the human embryos. But the problem is, once the government says, okay, we're going to fund this much of it, then it almost gives its stamp of approval on it. Bush, rather than taking a stand and saying, no, no way, we're not going to do this, I'm not going to permit this under my watch, instead he's done this compromise, quote-unquote, saying, okay, well, we'll just use these, but we won't use, but that's as far as we'll go. I guarantee you that's not as far as we'll go. We're going to go a lot further than we've ever imagined because this is the way human beings are. And I'm saying, I'm just trying to tie this in with Pilate. Pilate just figures, well, okay, I'll just have him beat and I'll draw the sympathy of the crowds and that'll be the end of that. Because remember, his wife, Pilate's wife, came out to him and said, hey, I have nothing to do with this just man because I have suffered much in a dream because of him. And that only added to his anxiety and to his fear and to his dilemma because he thought, man, there's something about this guy. He's on trial here, but there's a mystery about him. He stands there beaten to a pulp, but he has a dignity about him, a royalty about him that's just I can't put my finger on. And I'm sure that Pilate probably heard all kinds of stories about Jesus, and now he's confronted with him, and he just feels like, man, how do I get out of this? And I think this is a warning to us when it comes to trying to appease evil. It's not going to happen. And, you know, like I said, I put myself in his position and I say I probably would have done what he did because I know human nature. I would like to say, boy, if I was in his position, I would have called out the Roman legions and just, mowed them all down, and let Jesus go. But you know that that's the end of your job, it's the end of your career, it probably even be the end of you. But if you can take that stand before God, before heaven, I mean, that would be the thing to do. But you see, he was trying to hang on to his fleeting little position, and he's gone down in infamy. He's gone down in history, as every church that recites the Apostles' Creed says that Jesus suffered under Pontius Pilate and died. Okay, they got his name in there, so he didn't get away from it, even though he washed his hands of it. Look at what Pilate says in that verse 5. Jesus therefore came out wearing a crown of thorns and a purple robe, and Pilate said to them, "Behold the man." Interesting thing. He says, "Behold the man." Obviously, he's trying to get people to look at him like, okay, he's all beat up now. He's probably bloody from head to foot. We are told in prophecies that he had his beard ripped out, and he's probably, his face is distorted through the blows and stuff like that. But also, look what he says when we go further down here. Look what he says in that verse 14. The last thing he says to them, he says, "Behold your king." First of all, he says, "Behold your man." And then a few verses later, he says, "Behold your king." And it's almost like that's pretty profound to me because Pilate's saying, take a look at the man. And we got to ask ourselves, when we look at Jesus, what do we see? Do we just see the man or do we see the king? Do we just see the man or do we see the God-man? I mean, this is where it boils down to. If all we're going to see is the man, then obviously we've missed the whole point. And we've missed the whole point, not only to who Jesus is, but actually to who we are and to our existence, if all we see is the man. But if we can see the God-man, then everything else begins to fall in place. But he says, "Behold the man," and then what do the people say? The chief priests and the officers, they start stirring up the crowd, saying, "Crucify him, crucify him." And here Pilate is going down a slippery slope. I bet you he wished he could have backed up the whole train and just said, as soon as the elders, or as soon as the scribes and the Pharisees and Sadducees came to him, he would have said to them, hey, you, Jesus, stay here. He called in the Roman guard, said, you guys, out of here. You get out of my sight. And you get out, you know, I'll have you all arrested. He probably would just have them all arrested for inciting a riot. Just do something. And then let Jesus go. But no, he's trying to deal with the situation by compromising, and it's getting worse and worse and worse. And this is what's happened when we try to compromise with evil. This is what happens when we try to compromise with evil people. What happens when we try to compromise, you know, or appease wickedness. So he says in verse 7, it says, the Jews answered him, we have a law, and by that law he ought to die because he made himself out to be the Son of God. Now, look at that verse 7. You can't tell me that these people didn't know what Jesus claimed to be. I mean, they said it right here. He claims to be the Son of God. I mean, they were just infuriated with that. And yet, Jesus had certified his credentials as the Son of God over and over and over and over again by his works. Especially when he raised Lazarus from the dead. He said, Lazarus, come forth. It says that, man, when people saw that after Lazarus had been dead for 4 days, he said a lot of the people believed in Jesus. But then the interesting thing is that then a lot of the scribes and the Pharisees became all that more hardened, and they were determined, this guy's got to go. And not only does he have to go, we got to get rid of Lazarus too, because this person's just too hot to handle. So it's like Jesus showed them over and over and over again through his works that what he had to say as far as his person was the truth. He claimed to be the Son of God. Now, there's all kinds of people that run around throughout history claiming to be somebody important, but Jesus proved it. And there was no doubt in their mind who he was, because they said he claims to be the Son of God. So he's blasphemed as far as they're concerned. And in verse 8, it says, when Pilate therefore heard the statement, he was more afraid, and he entered into the praetorium again and said, Jesus, where are you from? But Jesus gave him no answer. So, in other words, Pilate, when he hears this, I mean, there's something that strikes his conscience and strikes his spirit and saying, man, there's something about this guy. And he says, he's the Son of God. And he goes, oh, man. You know, he goes back to talk to Jesus. Like, man, where are you from? And he didn't want to say, well, I'm from Bethlehem. I'm from Nazareth. No, he wanted to know, who are you? And Jesus doesn't answer him. So he says, hey, don't you realize that I have the authority to crucify you or to let you go? Again, see, Pilate, by his own words, by his own admission, has sealed his fate by saying, I have the authority, not these people here. I have the authority to crucify you or to free you. So even his own words came back to haunt him. So in other words, he couldn't just simply say, well, everything was just out of control and I had to do what I considered to be the right thing. No, you had the authority to do the right thing. You just didn't do the right thing. See what I'm saying? By his own admission, he had that authority. And what's interesting, too, is that Jesus doesn't answer him. So he says to them that he has that power over him. Jesus said to him, hey, you wouldn't have this power. All this power comes from God. And that, to me, says an awful lot. When we look at who's in running the world today, we wonder, how in the world can people like this be in charge if God is the one who grants authority, or all authority comes from heaven? But keep something in mind. A lot of times, God will send wicked, worthless, good-for-nothing leadership over a country because that's the type of people that deserve it. And that's why we have seen so very little leadership in this country, or in any other country of the world, for that matter, that's really worth a hoot. When you see countries that are cursed with dictators like Iraq or Iran or China, these people that are in control, they think that they're the ones who are the beginning and end all. But their authority comes from God. But how can such dictators, such people, such ruthless, good-for-nothing, worthless, people be in charge? Well, it's because this is a kind of a judgment against the people. So, and that's what's going to happen when the Antichrist comes to the head of the world. It's going to, his authority is actually going to begin, even though it's going to come from Satan, is God's going to allow it. Why? Because of the wickedness of mankind. And he's going to use this evil leader to chastise the world because of its sin and because of its wickedness. Okay, and then he says here in verse 11. I think this is very significant too. Jesus answered, "You would have no authority over me unless it had been given to you from above. For this reason, he who delivered me up to you has the greater sin." There's several things that are implied here. The one who gave him up to him, well, first it was Judas, but it was really Judas plus the religious leaders of that day, who were the scribes and the Pharisees, Sadducees, the high priest and the high priest's son-in-law. All these people, they had the greater sin. But what's implied here is that Pilate also had sinned. His sin just wasn't as severe as theirs. In other words, he's not exonerated from his role in this. He has sinned in this. Even though he sat there and washed his hands of it before this crowd, thinking that I have no responsibility in this situation, he nevertheless, before heaven, most certainly does. He says here in verse 12, it says, "As a result, Pilate made efforts to release him, but the Jews cried out, saying, 'If you release this man, you are no friend of Caesar's. Everyone who makes himself out to be a king opposes Caesar.'" Now, isn't this the most hypocritical statement you ever heard coming from their phony mouths? Mm-hmm. I mean, isn't it? First of all, they despise Caesar. They despise Rome. They held him in utmost contempt, and the last thing they wanted to do was give honor or homage or credence to Caesar, because they held him in utter contempt. But here it is, they almost see that they have more contempt for Christ than Caesar. Because what are they saying here? "If you release this man, you are no friend of Caesar's." Okay, now they're playing on Pilate, and they know that Pilate, like I said, he wasn't in very good standing with Rome. And if the emperor was to find out that, hey, there was a riot down there in Jerusalem, and he was the one who was in charge of keeping the peace, it would have been his job. It would have been his neck or whatever. So they know how to manipulate him. Well, you know what? Also, in regards to that, it says, "If you release this man, you're no friend of Caesar's. Everyone who makes himself out to be a king opposes Caesar." So they're almost like saying, hey, we have an allegiance to Caesar. That's what they're trying to say. Now, here's an interesting thing. Jesus gave a parable, and in the parable he talked about how the people who were supposed to be the Jews said that basically that we will not have this man reign over us in one of his parables. Well, the Jews did not want Jesus Christ to reign over them. They chose Caesar instead. Interesting that all we have to do is just take a shallow look, a brief look at history, the history of the Jewish people, and you can see that because they chose Caesar over Christ, they have suffered immeasurably and innumerably under all the Caesars throughout all the centuries. I mean, every single country in the world, they have suffered, you know, horrible persecution and tribulation and imprisonment and death and torture and bias and hatred. Why? Because we have no king but Caesar. So it's almost as though God says, okay, you don't want your king. Well, you want these other kings? Have them. See what they're going to do to you. And they have suffered ever since. I mean, when Pilate said, I wash my hands of this man's blood, they said, may his blood be upon us and upon our children. I mean, they brought the biggest curse you can imagine down on themselves and their children's children. It's a frightful when you look at this to how accurate the word of God is and how, you know, profound our actions and our inactions and our words and our, you know, commitments can have such long reaching effects after generation after generation. And then in verse 13 it says, "When Pilate therefore heard these words, he brought out Jesus and sat down on the judgment seat at the place called the pavement," but in Hebrew it's Gabbatha. "And now it was about the day of preparation for the Passover. It was about the sixth hour, and he said to the Jews, 'Behold your king.' They therefore cried out, 'Away with him, away with him, crucify him.' And Pilate said to them, 'Shall I crucify your king?' The chief priest answered, 'We have no king but Caesar.' And so he then delivered him up to them to be crucified. And it took Jesus, therefore, and he went out bearing his own cross to the place called the place of the skull, which is in Hebrew called Golgotha, where they crucified him, and with him two other men, one on either side and Jesus in between. And Pilate wrote an inscription also, and he put it on the cross, and it was written, 'Jesus the Nazarene, the King of the Jews.' Therefore, this inscription many of the Jews read, for the place where Jesus was crucified was near the city, and it was written in Hebrew and Latin and Greek. And so the chief priests and the Jews were saying to Pilate, do not write the King of the Jews, but that he said, I am the King of the Jews. And Pilate answered, what I have written, I have written. And now, here, almost see, now Pilate develops a backbone. You know, it's almost like he's been pushed this far, and that's it. He knows that he has been used by these people, and he despises these people. Okay, and so he writes this inscription, and he's written it in Latin and Hebrew and Greek. And remember that that this was right smack in the middle of, or actually just before, one of the major feast days, which was the Passover. Mm-hmm. And so you had Jews from all over the world that were coming to celebrate the Passover in Jerusalem. Not just Jews, but a lot of devout Gentiles as well. So the whole place was very cosmopolitan in terms of, you know, it was just a city that had all these different people and diversities and languages and stuff like that. So it's written above the Jesus' cross that Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews. And, you know, of course, God is the one who's orchestrating this. But it was like the Jews thought this, obviously were offended by this. They said, hey, say that he said it, but Pilate will not budge on this. And it's almost as though, why couldn't he have shown that kind of courage and that kind of backbone first? But now they've pushed him to the point where you can just see his contempt and hatred for them. It's almost like, if you ask me one more thing, I'm going to throw you all in the can or have you crucified too. I mean, he's so fed up with them. Okay, but here it is. He sticks to his guns on this, and I think that you can see how God orchestrated that, because he is their king. No, not that he just said he was their king, but he is their king. Anyway, it says here in verse 20, it says, therefore, this inscription many of the Jews read, for the place where Jesus was crucified was near the city, and it was written in Hebrew and Latin and Greek. And so the chief priests and the Jews were saying to Pilate, do not write the King of the Jews, but that he said, I am the King of the Jews. And Pilate answered, what I have written, I have written. The soldiers, therefore, when they crucified Jesus, took his outer garments and made four parts, a part to every soldier, and also the tunic. Now the tunic was seamless, woven in one piece. And they said therefore to one another, let us not tear it, but cast lots for it, to decide whose it shall be, that the scriptures may be fulfilled. They divided my outer garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots. Therefore the soldiers did these things, but standing by the cross of Jesus, his mother and his mother's sister, and Mary, wife of Cleophas, and Mary Magdalene. And when Jesus therefore saw his mother and the disciple whom he loved standing by her, he said to his mother, woman, behold your son. And he said to the disciple, behold your mother. And from that hour, the disciple took her into his own household. Okay, just backing up a little bit. It's talking about now Jesus is nailed to the cross, and they strip him of his garments. And the Roman soldiers now are casting lots for his garment. And, of course, they don't rip that one piece, his cloak, because it's seamless. And this was a fulfillment in, you know, Psalm 22. And I think it's very, very significant that there's, on the day that Jesus died, there was no less than 28 prophecies that were fulfilled, as many as 33 different prophecies that were fulfilled, old-time prophecies. And I'll just read you a number of them, because I think it's very significant that these are the things that were predicted that would happen on that day. For example, he would ride into Jerusalem on a donkey. That was predicted in Zechariah 9:9. He would enter the temple. That was predicted in Malachi 3:1. He would be betrayed by a friend. That was written in Psalm 41:9. He would be sold for 30 pieces of silver. That was written in Zechariah 11:12. The silver would be thrown into the temple. That was written in Zechariah 11:13. The silver would be used for a potter's field. That was written in Zechariah 11:13. He would be forsaken by his disciples. That was written in Zechariah 13:7. He would be accused by false witnesses. That was written in Psalm 35:11. He would remain silent before his accusers. That was written in Isaiah 53:7. He would be wounded and bruised. That was written in Isaiah 53:5. He would be whipped and spit upon. That was written in Isaiah 50 verse 6, and also Malachi 5 verse 1. He would be mocked. That would be written in Psalm 22 7 and 8. His hands and his feet would be pierced. That was written in Psalm 22 16. He would be crucified with thieves. That was written in Isaiah 53 12. People would shake their heads at him. That was written in Psalm 109 verse 25. His clothes would be divided and his lot cast for them. That was written in Psalm 22:18, which we just read here. He would be offered gall and vinegar to drink. That was written in Psalm 69:21. The exact words of his death cry were predicted. That was written in Psalm 22:1. Not one of his bones would be broken. That was Psalm 34:20. His heart would literally burst. That was Psalm 22:14. His side would be pierced. That was Zechariah 12:10. The darkness would fall in broad daylight. That was Amos 8:9. He would be buried in a rich man's tomb. That was Isaiah 53:9. He would be resurrected from the dead. That was Psalm 16:10. Psalm 30:3. Psalm 41:10. Psalm 118, and also Hosea 6:1, verse 2. You know, all of these things put together. I mean, what are the chances of anybody being able to fulfill those by pure coincidence, by pure happenstance? Even one or two of them would have been very, very improbable that anything like that could happen, instead of having 28 to 33 different prophecies fulfilled. But what I wanted to do is, you don't have to turn there, I want to read you what Isaiah said in Isaiah 53, because he deals with this, and I think it's very significant. You don't have to turn there, but in tying it in with the death of Jesus, keep in mind that Isaiah, when he wrote these words, he wrote them over 700 years before the birth of Christ. And this is what he predicted. He says, who has believed our message, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? For he, Christ, grew up before him, God the Father, like a tender shoot and like a root out of parched ground. He had no stately form or majesty that we should look upon him, nor appearance that we should be attracted to him. He was despised and forsaken of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, and like one from whom men hide their face, he was despised and we did not esteem him. I mean, Jesus just grew up totally anonymous. And there was nothing about him that just, you know, people flocked to him or crowded to him. He was just very, very ordinary looking individual. But he was a man who was despised, and he was lowly esteemed. I mean, people just didn't look at him as being important at all. And Isaiah predicted, he says, surely our griefs he himself bore, and our sorrows he carried. Yet we ourselves esteemed him stricken and smitten of God and afflicted. Remember when he's hanging on a cross, people were shaking their heads and saying, you know, all kinds of things about him, you know, deserving to this. He says, verse 5 says, but he was pierced through for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The chastening of our well-being fell upon him, and by his scourging we are healed. All of us like sheep have gone astray. Each of us has turned to his own way. But the Lord caused the iniquity of us all to fall upon him. There's nobody in the world that could say, well, you know, Jesus didn't really have to die for me because, you know, I'm perfect. Well, all of us have gone astray. There's not one person who can claim, well, I didn't really need the blood of Christ because I've never done anything wrong in my life. He says, he was opposed and he was afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. Like a lamb that is led to slaughter and like a sheep that is silent before his shears, so he did not open his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away. And as for his generation, who considered that he was cut off out of the land of the living for the transgression of my people for whom the stroke was due? Now listen to this. It's talking specifically about his death now. He's saying he's taken out of the land of living for the purpose of being a substitute for the people who deserve to die. And then it says here that his grave was assigned to be with the wicked men. He died between two thieves. Yet with a rich man in his death. And he was buried in the tomb of Joseph of Arimathea, who was a wealthy man. Although he had done no violence, nor was there any deceit in his mouth. But the Lord was pleased to crush him, putting him to grief. If he would render himself as a guilt offering, he would see his offspring and him would prolong his days. Now he's talking about his resurrection. Okay? Because it doesn't make any sense if he's saying he's put to death and then he's going to see his offspring. In other words, see the fruits of his labor here. That if he would render himself as a guilt offering, he would see his offspring and he would prolong his days. And the good pleasure of the Lord would prosper in his hand. As a result of the anguish of his soul, he will see it and be satisfied. By his knowledge, the righteous one, my servant, will justify the many, as he will bear their iniquities. Therefore, I will allot him a portion with the great, and he will divide the booty with the strong, because he poured out himself to death. So it's talking about his resurrection. And he was numbered with the transgressors, yet he himself bore the sins of many and interceded on for the transgressors. I mean, I frankly cannot comprehend how any devout Jew could read Isaiah 53, okay, and not make the connection if they would take the time and the energy and effort to read the death of Christ. How could they not put the two and two together? As a new Christian, I went down to a Jewish synagogue on Riverside Boulevard specifically to talk to the rabbi there, whoever was in charge there, to get me a Jewish Bible. And I got a Jewish Bible because I wanted to read Isaiah 53 out of their own Bible. And as a matter of fact, I think I have it somewhere here. But I was just astounded that, you know, it's basically word for word. And just wonder how these people couldn't see it. Well, it's right there in front of them. Okay, and then in verse 25, therefore the soldiers did these things, but there were standing by the cross of Jesus his mother and his mother's sister Mary, the wife of Cleophas, and Mary Magdalene. And when Jesus therefore saw his mother and the disciples whom he loved standing nearby, he said to his mother, "Woman, behold your son." And he said to his disciples, "Behold your mother." And from that hour the disciple took her into his own household. What's transpiring here is that John the apostle, you know, he kind of held back, but he was stood there at the foot of Christ, you know, and God used him as a witness. He was an eyewitness to everything that happened. When Jesus was hanging there, Jesus recognized that he was no longer in a position to care for his aging mother. So he looked to John and said, "Hey, this is now your mother. I want you to take over my job and taking care of her." I think it's very significant because what you see, Jesus is concerned in the midst of all of his pain for the welfare of, you know, his mother. And I don't want to get off on a tangent here, but I sometimes feel a little annoyed with the Christians who belittle Christ's mother. And I think they do this out of almost being paranoid, thinking, well, the Catholics, they worship Mary. Well, first of all, Catholics do not worship Mary. They do not deify Mary. Catholics teach from day one that Mary is a created being. I think anybody, if you had a close friend, if they honored your mother, it would be pleasing to you. I mean, you know, that's to me, it's just common sense. If you dishonored, you know, your best friend's mother, then that would come between you, I would think. Anyway, Jesus is now, you know, hanging on the cross, and he's basically, there's seven different things that are said from the cross. Okay, and I think they're all very significant. See if we can remember. First of all, Jesus said, "Father, forgive them, for they don't know what to do." He also says, "Today thou shalt be with me in paradise," talking to the thief on the cross, remember? He said, what we just read here as far as talking to John, "Mother, behold thy son, son, behold thy mother." He also said, "I thirst," which was a fulfillment of prophecy. He also said that, my God, why hast thou forsaken me?" I also said, there's a couple other things. Oh, yeah, it is finished. Very good. "And into your hands I commend my spirit." I think that's what the seventh saying is from the cross. And I don't have time to get into to each one of them right now, but each one of those are very significant, and you could probably give a sermon in each one, even in of themselves. Okay, and there was also seven things that were spoken to the cross, and maybe I'll get into that next week. But anyway, just backing up to that, verse 28 says, "After this, Jesus, knowing all things had already been accomplished, in order that the scriptures might be fulfilled, said, I am thirsty. And a jar of sour wine was standing there, so they poured a sponge, they put a sponge full of sour wine upon a branch of hyssop and brought it to his mouth. And when Jesus therefore had received the sour wine, he said, it is finished. He bowed his head and gave up his spirit." In order to fulfill the scriptures, that it had been predicted in the Psalm 69, that Jesus would say, "I thirst," or "I am thirsty." And obviously, he had to be totally dehydrated because he had lost all this fluid, all this blood, and all this water. Okay, and we know after he did give up his spirit, that his side is pierced, and then out of his side comes forth blood and water. Verse 31. It says, the Jews, therefore, because it was the day of preparation, so that the body should not remain upon the cross on the Sabbath, for the Sabbath was a high day, and asked Pilate that their legs might be broken and that they might be taken away. So the soldiers, therefore, came and broke the legs of the first man and of the other man who was crucified with him. But coming to Jesus, when they saw that he was already dead, they did not break his legs. But one of the soldiers pierced his side with a spear, and immediately there came out blood and water. And he who has seen has borne witness, and this witness is true, and he knows that he is telling the truth, so that you also may believe. For these things came to pass, that the scriptures might be fulfilled, not a bone of him shall be broken. And again another scripture says, they shall look upon him whom they have pierced. And after these things, Joseph of Arimathea, being a disciple of Jesus, but a secret one, for fear of the Jews, asked Pilate that he might take away the body of Jesus. And Pilate granted him permission. And he came therefore and took away his body. And Nicodemus came also, who had at first come to him at night, bringing a mixture of myrrh and aloes, about 100 pounds in weight. And so they took the body of Jesus and bound it in linen wrappings with the spices, as is the burial custom of the Jews. Now in the place where he was crucified, there was a garden, and in the garden there was a new tomb, in which no one had been laid. Therefore, on account of the Jewish day of preparation, because of the tomb was nearby, they laid Jesus there. Okay, in the concluding verses of what's transpiring here is that you got Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus. Both of them are secret disciples. Interesting thing, they were secret disciples. And then you had the open disciples, which were, of course, the 12 apostles, right? The 12 apostles all scattered, okay, when the chips were down. And now the two secret disciples actually come out from the woodwork and they pick up what his others had left off. I think that's kind of significant because sometimes there's people, you know, all throughout history, and certainly people within the church who are very visible, and sometimes they drop the ball. And you never know until Judgment Day or until that time when the rewards are meted out, that sometimes the people who you would not assume, or you would at least assume sometimes would be given much recognition, they may very well be the ones who are honored greatly because they came forth when the others let Christ down. I mean, I think that's kind of significant that these two showed the moral courage in a time when the others lost all courage and they were just cowards. And these two came out in the open. And these two had a lot to lose because they were up there in the elite as far as the religious circles were concerned, and that was the religious elite are the ones who had crucified him. So in other words, when they took that step, they knew, realized that, hey, this is really going to anger some people who could do us a lot of damage. But they nevertheless stepped out and did exactly that on behalf of Christ. It says here that he had a spear rammed into his side, and then that's how John witnessed the blood and water that came forth. And it's believed, the tradition says, or the early church history says, it was if I'm not mistaken, it was a Roman soldier by the name of Longinus who rammed that spear into him. And we know from other scriptures that when he did that, he just got overwhelmed with a sense that he said this was truly a righteous man. That there was something about this man, and there's, you know, that makes him a righteous man. And legend says that Longinus became a Christian because of that experience, and John was there and he witnessed that. So I mean, you kind of put this all together, and I think that you see how God orchestrated it in such a way that, you know, it's just, I sit back and I'm just flabbergasted to see how all this came together in within a 24-hour period of all these prophecies being fulfilled, and how it proved beyond a doubt. I mean, just reading Isaiah 53, how can anybody read that and not make the connection? It's just mind-boggling. It's almost like you have to be willfully ignorant to not see the truth of that, and how something like that could have been prophesied 700 years before the event and then be fulfilled with such incredible accuracy. Does anybody have anything want to add or share to what we read?